Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
We're increasing the microloan. We're reducing the years necessary to access the very important loan programs at USDA. We're revising the beginning farmer designation to make it a little bit easier for those who are beginning farmers to take full advantage of the capital opportunities that FSA presents.
Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack on USDA's proposed budget.
All of this is designed to make it a little bit easier for people to get in the farming business, a little bit easier to access the resources of USDA, regardless of the fact that you may not have a set number of years of experience. The ability to get a small microloan to begin starting a farming operation. This is, again, an example of a budget that supports the notion of a bottom-up and middle-out philosophy.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Please, 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 if you have not gotten with your crop insurance agent, please take the time, give them a call. Hopefully they're reaching out to you.
Marcia Bunger is the administrator of USDA's Risk Management Agency, RMA, talking about the sales closing date for spring planted crops.
March 15th for spring seeded crops is the sales closing date. And it's really important to take that time to visit with your agent to understand what your coverage is going to be, not just when a disaster strikes, but the dollars of that coverage. And also the options. You know, RMA continues to roll out new options every year. It may not be necessarily in your particular operation, but it's always good to get that little bit of education from your crop insurance agent. You know, crop insurance agents are RMA's boots on the ground, and they do such a fabulous job. They care about their customers, their farmers, agriculture, so please take that time to understand your levels of coverage. And in addition, I know, because I'm a farmer myself, that your lender cares what kind of coverage you have as well. So also visit with your lender. If you're a little bit undecided where you need to be, I know you can get some great advice as far as your own individual operation and what your debt load is, what the input costs are, and just so that hopefully you can sleep better at night knowing that you have the right kind of crop insurance coverage.
She also talks about a new program, the Double Cropping Initiative.
I'm so excited. I'm so proud of the RMA team. They did a tremendous amount of work in a very short period of time at the ask of this administration, the secretary. Because of the invasion in Ukraine, we really recognized as a country the need to step up maybe and produce even more on the same acres. And with that, RMA reached out to almost 100 stakeholders so that we could get feedback into the areas where we could expand and do double cropping with both grain sorghum and with soybeans. We expanded to almost 1,500 counties throughout the country, and that is so following a fall seeded crop like winter wheat, and then to come back in and plant either soybeans or grain sorghum, depending upon the area of where you're at, and to be able to then make that decision if you want to get crop insurance with a written agreement. We've improved the red tape in some of those areas with blanket written agreements, which will make it easier for both the grower and the agent to implement those written agreements, but yet also maybe in some areas to no longer even have to have a written agreement. And by this summer, after we know what the spring plantings are, I'm really excited to look at that data and to be able to report back to the secretary. This has been a huge success.
Now, the double cropping initiative is not available to every county across the country, but she says
they can go online and see the map of where it's been expanded to, but I would highly recommend going to your crop insurance agent so that you can have that discussion with them. Your agent is going to be able to tell you if that expansion includes your area, but then also what will be the requirements for the paperwork that you're going to need. So get with your crop insurance agent if you're looking at planting that spring crop of either grain sorghum or soybeans.
Marcia Bunger with the Risk Management Agency. It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
We have had a good couple of years in terms of pricing, and these past couple of years of pricing have more or less encouraged very poor marketing with higher prices as the year goes on.
Rich Nelson is chief strategist with Allendale.
What we're looking at right now is this is going to be a transition year, though, in this supply change and probably moving towards these next couple of years as well. So we are certainly encouraging producers to be very active now in understanding this market, the potential pitfalls awaiting us, certainly after these recent price declines, as well as what could be further price declines ahead here.
Is there room to go lower?
Actually, there is. And the issue here right now is the fact that we're still dealing with demand concerns here for both corn and wheat, for instance. We can argue there's a long-term story for soybeans, which is valid, but the question is, given our problems with demand on the corn side, and potentially with this discussion on production, especially as we're looking forward to a more normal type of production year, I think this is going to be an issue which is still quite relevant for these next few months.
So what's happening in South America?
Brazil is doing just fine. Obviously, a late planting corn as well as a late harvest soybean. I think that's a valid discussion, but the problem is it's not a production hit. We still have full crops in store right now, and you could even argue that even with Argentina's problems, some of the provinces have a 100-year drought. They have a 32% cut in yields right now versus starting trend. So the point for us right now is there are concerns with South America. The problem from the market standpoint is USDA recognized those on Wednesday's supply-demand report with these sharp cuts for Argentina. However, the market did not move. In fact, went lower after hearing of those sharp cuts.
Then there's corn and soybeans and China.
And that's going to be a big issue, maybe not for us on the U.S. side, but certainly the China story will continue to be played out quite actively these next few months. One thing we've got to point out with the export side, though, is we still have a price disadvantage. Corn right now running about $15 per metric ton under Brazil. Soybean side, we're as much as $41 per ton under, Brazil has a $41 price advantage. So the problem is for us right now is we're wrapping up our old crop discussions, finding out lower than expected exports, especially for corn. And now on top of that, we have the questions with new crop, whether this could be acreage and or yield in these months ahead.
What about the corn situation with China?
I find it really interesting. We're having this extremely heavy arguments with Mexico right now. Canada's also joined in recent days for this discussion. The trade right now feels that there's no believable way that Mexico can pull this off. It's unrealistic even in the first place, even separate from the legal issues. So most of us are still ignoring Mexico as being a valid issue, but it'll certainly be played out in politics these next few weeks.
Finally, what about wheat?
One thing the market has a clear understanding of is this concerning issue of wheat conditions do not exactly match up with actual final yields. And the market knows very well that no matter how hard this terrible crop looks going into winter and coming out of winter, the key determinant of winter wheat yields is spring rains. And as it stands right now, we certainly have the soft red area seeing, and they will continue to see very good rains. We are going to see some moderate rains for the eastern half of the plains in the weeks ahead. So it is an issue, it's a concern, but as of right now, the trade's still holding its breath, waiting for this spring rain story.
Rich Allen, chief strategist with Allendale. It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
I'm from East Central Iowa. I'm just really about 15 miles from the Mississippi River. We farm soybeans, corn, beef cattle, and a few sheep. My son's in the operation now, and he handles the show when I'm gone doing things like this. But dad's retired, and it's a multi-generational farm. We're pretty diversified, but we get it done.
Dave Walton is an Iowa soybean producer and a member of the Clean Fuels Association.
This industry is really built on soybean farmers. We started the organization when it was NBB, now it's Clean Fuels Alliance America, just to open it up and make it more inclusive of all the different products that we represent, so biodiesel, renewable diesel, and sustainable aviation fuel. But it's really important for us because it's a use for our soybeans. It adds about 8% to the value of our bean. A 500-acre soybean farmer, that's about $34,000 a year that puts in his pocket just from this industry. So we're here to protect that industry and make sure that it continues to grow.
Recently, EPA out with their renewable volume obligations, or RVOs. Why are producers upset?
The number was actually shockingly low for us. We were expecting some larger growth in that number. We were expecting between 500 and 650 million gallon growth for the three-year period that it covers. We actually saw 50 to 65 is what EPA is telling us. So they actually got it off by a decimal point. They needed to add a zero behind that number to get it right. The intent of the RVO was to be kind of a stretch goal for the industry. And this is, Congress wanted to make it so that it built up to that number every time they put a new number out. Actually, what EPA has done is sort of cap that market. So there's actually one renewable diesel plant being built right now that would use all of the increase over the next 3 years by itself. EPA didn't take into consideration the growth that was about to happen in the industry. So, as Greg mentioned, with the crush plants, we had four crush plants that have been proposed in Iowa. When EPA came out with that lower number, they hit a pause button, and those plants aren't being built right now because there's no additional demand for oil. So those folks that were growing soybeans in the area near the crush plant that were set to get a better basis or a better price for their crop now are missing that opportunity. And it goes back to the rural economy. So EPA really needed to take a look at that, and it's money off the table for a lot of those folks that are growing soybeans around those crush plants that are no longer being built. So we have an opportunity now. We're past the comment period. EPA is going to take another look at that. We're still hoping they do the right thing and bring that number back up to that 500 to 600 million gallon a year growth over a three-year period. But if they don't, they're really putting a damper on the entire industry, from farmers all the way out to end users.
So what is there to do? Kurt Kavarik is with the Clean Fuels Alliance America.
We're engaging right now, particularly in the House of Representatives. Representative Hinson from Iowa is circulating a letter among her colleagues to make this point to the administration, how badly they missed the mark. We anticipate there'll be additional efforts like that in the Senate, perhaps even among governors. And what I would say is, as a soybean farmer, today we're adding about just over a dollar per bushel to the value of a soybean because of what we add in value to the oil. And we've seen almost 20 announcements to expand soybean crush in 10 states. An economic infusion of about $5 billion. All of that is partly due to the innovation and the desire for low-carbon fuels and the success of the renewable fuels program. So all of this could be undermined and undercut if we don't get these volumes up. That investment is not assured to happen, and it's all being put at risk because the EPA failed to recognize what's happening in the industry, both in terms of soy crush expansion and renewable fuel production.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Well, we've rolled out the first two agreements today for the Partnerships for Climate Smart Commodities program.
Robert Bonney is Undersecretary for USDA's Farm Production and Conservation.
And that's an effort to work with farmers, with ranchers, with forest owners to deploy climate smart practices at scale through incentives, through voluntary agreements. And so we're excited about that. Two projects today, one by the Iowa Soybean Association, one by Farmers for Soil Health, are going to work with farmers on the ground through commodity groups and others to put those practices into place. We're going to measure and monitor the outcomes, and we're going to demonstrate that agriculture can do really good things for the climate and for sustainability.
Speaking at Commodity Classic says it's a new approach for USDA.
Yeah, this is a different model. Our service centers are going to remain there for folks that need technical assistance, financial assistance through our Farm Bill programs. This is an effort to work with folks on the ground in a different way to provide the same type of assistance. It's going to be more flexible, and farmers are going to work with those partners on the ground. In the case of the Iowa Soybean Association, it'll be with the Iowa Soybean Association and other commodity groups. Farmers for Soil Health, same thing. There are a lot of commodity groups, corn, soybean, and pork, that are working with the Farmers for Soil Health, and they're going to deploy both the technical assistance and the practices. And so we're excited about that model. We think it might provide more flexibility, allow us to reach more farmers.
So what's the end game?
There are really two end games here. One's pretty tangible. There are significant reductions we can make in greenhouse gases. We think it's north of 50 million metric tons. We think we can reach millions of acres, 25 million acres of working lands in the United States. And we think the model of a this is a commodity program. It's about supporting the production of climate-smart commodities. We think that's all important. There's an intangible outcome here, which is we want to build a model, a voluntary, incentive-based, collaborative model that works with farmers, ranchers, and forest owners that we think will work here domestically, and we think it could work internationally. We want to demonstrate that agriculture can be a hero when it comes to climate change. That's a little less numbers-oriented than, you know, thinking about acres and tons, but ultimately that's what we want to do.
As part of that announcement, Ben West, Executive Director for Farmers for Soil Health.
Farmers for Soil Health, a collaboration between the United Soybean Board, the National Corn Growers Association, and National Pork Board to advance soil conservation practices, particularly conservation tillage, cover crops, and other things that will be good for farms and good for farmers.
And agrees this is the next big advancement in ag.
If you look back at the development, for example, of no-till a few decades ago, that was a big advance in conservation and agriculture, and we're on the cusp of one now. Having deeper understanding of the biological qualities of the soils and how that relates to soil health and to farmer bottom lines is a really big one. And what's really exciting is farmers are going to be able to develop these practices in ways that support their operation and make their operations more resilient and more profitable, but also provide tremendous public value by reducing erosion, improving water quality, sequestering carbon, and a whole portfolio of environmental benefits.
As for a return on investment?
If you, as we do, if you talk to farmers who have been using cover crops for a while, kind of the universal story that a lot of farmers tell us is it takes a few years to learn it, to really figure out how it works within their system, and then the benefits start, you know, they start piling up. Here at Commodity Classic, I've ran into many farmers who have told me, if not for cover crops, I don't know if I would be able to be successful in my operation. They've just become an integral, essential part of what we do.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
So we have seen a mild decline in fertilizer prices in recent days. The question for us is whether we're going to have a lower corn price also matched up with a lower fertilizer price, which is something the fertilizer people are trying to argue against right now.
Rich Nelson is chief strategist with Allendale.
The main issue for us right now is we're looking at break-even still in that 540 to 560 area, and this is basis Midwest pricing for corn. We're now looking at new crop futures, actually suggesting some trouble with that break-even discussion.
But in many instances, we see fertilizer moving up the Mississippi River. Paul Rohde is with the Waterways Council.
WERDA is the typical vehicle, legislative vehicle, for authorization. So whether it's policy or actual projects, they all need to be authorized before you have an opportunity to fund them and construct them in the case of locks. So WERDA is our normal authorization legislation. It's an every other year legislation. It wasn't always that way. When I started doing this, we'd go 7 or so years in between WERDA bills. But now we're on a good clip and have been since 2014, where it's every other year. And that's another thing that we do is impress upon legislators the importance of having that kind of touch-base legislation that WERDA provides every other year so that we can stay on top of the necessary construction needs for locks and dams or maybe a policy need.
He explains that Water Resources Development Act, or WERDA, is the authorization. Doesn't mean Congress writes the check.
WERDA is exactly that. It's an authorization legislation that greenlights the potential for funding. Once you get the potential, you've got to go after that funding every fiscal year. We had a unique situation with the infrastructure bill last year that provided funding for locks and dams and other infrastructure. But by and large, it's a play with Congress every fiscal year to make our case to include funding for lock and dam construction. Operation and maintenance is part of that as well. So it's a little like painting that bridge when you get to the end of the bridge and you got to go back to the beginning. So it is a lot of work to impress upon Congress the importance of this and the importance of their action. This is a classic out of sight, out of mind situation. Most people don't think about barges. It's not kitchen table conversation. And so legislators need to be led, quite literally, to learning about how important river transportation really is.
But they have skin in the game.
You know, we are a great example of user pay, users say. The industry pays a diesel tax of 29 cents a gallon on commercial use of our inland waterway system. they're the only industry that pays any private money into the lock and dam capital improvements. And they're also the most heavily taxed industry as far as surface transportation goes. All that said, it was not too long ago that the industry came together and unanimously and voluntarily told Congress, look, we've got to get after this backlog of construction and repairs for locks and dams, so we want to actually raise our tax by 45%. And that raised quite a few eyebrows in Washington, D.C. They don't get a lot of people saying, hey, raise our taxes for us. And that had to go through an authorization process, a legislative process. It just doesn't happen magically, so it's got to go through the functions of legislation in on Capitol Hill. But we were successful, and that brought more money into what's called the Inland Waterways Trust Fund. And that trust fund is paired with the annual appropriations process to fund construction and major rehabilitations of our lock and dam infrastructure.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Fertilizer prices went from a period of historic lows just a few years ago to record highs.
Corey Rosenbusch is president and CEO of the Fertilizer Institute, recently explaining to members of the House Ag Committee.
And it was really that volatility that was so impactful to the farmer. Fertilizer materials are each very different products that are all resource dependent and are all very different markets. The United States is fortunate to have significant production of nitrogen and phosphates, but we import over 80% of our potash from Canada. Globally, the United States only counts for about 7% of total fertilizer production, and over 90% of all fertilizer is actually used outside of the United States. So if you hear nothing else I say today, hear this. Fertilizer is a globally traded commodity subject to global supply and demand factors. So as we look at those global supply and demand factors, you have to start with geopolitics. We had Belarus that was sanctioned, removing about 20% of global potash supply that they produce. You had China, the world's largest producer of fertilizer, who restricted their exports. You have Russia, who's the world's largest global supplier of fertilizer, who also had sanctions from many countries as the war broke out in the Ukraine. And Russia also supplies much of Europe's natural gas. As a result, we saw nearly 70% of all European nitrogen plants shuttered during that period. Natural gas is that key feedstock for all ammonia production, but also the energy for ammonia, and that's the building block for every nitrogen fertilizer product. It counts for about 70 to 90% of the production cost of ammonia. And we saw natural gas prices reach over $100 per MMBTU in Europe last August. Fertilizer demand is also driven by crop prices, which we have seen reach record highs. Global grain stock-to-use ratios are the tightest they've been in 8 years, and it will likely take years to rebalance those. Logistics has been a huge issue for our industry. Over 60% of all fertilizer moves by rail, and we've seen poor rail service that was compounded by low water levels in the Mississippi River, reducing barge traffic, and, of course, trucking capacity issues as well. Now, good news in recent months for the farmer is that fertilizer prices have come down. Farmers have definitely taken a wait-and-see approach as we approach the spring planting season. European nitrogen plants have restarted. China has slowly begun exporting product. Russia trade flows have shifted and actually had a record year of exports last year. And finally, we expect market fundamentals to remain in place for the foreseeable future, with high planted acres, low grain stocks to use ratio, and high grain prices means that fertilizer demand will remain strong. So, if it's a global supply and demand issue, what can Congress do? In the interest of time, I'll refer to my written testimony where we've outlined a number of policy solutions for the administration and for Congress. But I can summarize those all by saying that fertilizer plants are capital-intensive facilities, sometimes costing as much as $4 billion to build. So if one wanted to bolster fertilizer supply for the American farmer, the most significant impact that you can have to mitigate our biggest risk is to provide regulatory certainty.
Corey Rosenbusch with the Fertilizer Institute. It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Minor changes noted in USDA's March crop production reports and supply and demand estimates. The U.S. orange production forecast rose slightly month over month, yet will still be down 25% year over year. Turning to domestic commodity balance sheets, an upward adjustment in ending stocks for corn led to a decrease of one dime to the season-ending average price, now at $6.60 a bushel. No change in the season-ending average price for soybeans, despite a decrease in ending stocks from the previous month. The news internationally regarding beans was an 8 million ton decrease in production forecast from Argentina. Meanwhile, rice production forecasts from India, if realized, would set a new record. The forecast up 7 million tons month over month. Global wheat production forecasts continue to increase. In March, up over 5 million tons due to production increases in Kazakhstan, Australia, and India. I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.